I want to start out by thanking Jean-Francois for inviting me. This is my first time in Paris in almost 11 years, which I can't imagine how that's happened, but it has. It's very good to be here even while the strike is going on. I want to also thank all of you for coming, and I know because of the strike that was a much bigger deal than it normally would have been, so I appreciate your making the effort to get here. And so I want to tell you today about some old work and some new work. The new work is going to be on the theory of Malthusian flocks. Don't worry if you're not familiar with that term. It's a term that I invented, and I've been trying to get the field to adopt, and hopefully this will go some way towards doing that, and I'll define what I mean by that. Roughly speaking, the title says it all. It's a flock with birth and death. And so just to give you an idea of what I'm going to be talking about, I'm going to start by telling you what I'm not going to be talking about, although I will actually spend the first half of my talk talking about this, which is what I call immortal flocks. So an immortal flock is something like this. This is a collection of something like 100,000 flamingos in Africa. It's an enormous system. First of all, it contains an enormous number of creatures, about 100,000. It's also physically enormous. It's more than a kilometer on a side. And this is a three-dimensional system, so it's several hundred kilometers deep and about a kilometer on a side. And in this flock, we don't have to worry about birds being born or dying on the wing. Okay, so as you watch the evolution of this flock, the total number of flamingos is conserved, and that's an important ingredient in thinking about the dynamics of these systems. To make a long story short, a Malthusian flock is one in which that's not true. It's a flock in which creatures are being born and dying on the same time scale that the motion is taking place on. And that leads to a very different dynamics, as I'll describe. Okay, so anyway, the first part of my talk is going to be reviewing what we know about immortal flocks, and this is an example of one. Here's an example of one that at first glance looks a lot smaller. This is a mitotic spindle. This, probably a lot of you know more about this than I do, but this is a structure that forms inside any cell before it divides. And here the DNA is in the middle, and we have this enormous structure that's made out of big biological polymers called microtubules and smaller proteins that act as motors that propel these microtubules. Now, this is a pretty small system. This is 40 microns across, but in a sense, it's much bigger than the flock I just showed you, because if you ask how many constituents does this system contain, how many microtubules are in this, the answer is billions. Okay? So this is an enormous system. It's also enormous on the scale of the individual microtubules, which have a diameter of order tens of nanometers, and this structure is 40 microns across. So this is a very big system. It's also a flock, which is not obvious in this picture, but it's true. If you look at if you draw a line through the middle of this and look at all the microtubules on this side, on average, they're all moving to the right. And in fact, they're all converging on this focus up here, whereas the ones on this side are all moving to the left and converging on this focus over here. So any half of this is a gigantic flock. It's a gigantic collection of self-propelled things that are all moving in the same direction. And that's the phenomenon I want to understand. That's what I mean when I use the term flocking. So what I'm going to tell you about today is, first, the hydrodynamic theory that was developed about 25 years ago by Yuhai Tu and I to describe immortal flocks, flocks in which there's number conservation. And I'm not going to tell you everything we know about those, but I'm going to tell you how you formulate a hydrodynamic theory for such a thing, how you formulate an equation that plays the same role for immortal flocks that, say, the Navier-Stokes equation plays for simple fluids. And if you want to read about this, there's this review paper in Annals of Physics in 2005. And then I'm going to talk about Malthusian flocks, where you change the game by allowing the number of flockers to change during the process of motion. Okay? And you think of that as happening due to birth and death of the individual creatures. There's two pieces to that work. There's a study of two-dimensional Malthusian flocks, which I did back in 2012. In fact, I had the original idea for this the last time I was here in Paris. And then recently, Lei-Ming Chen, Chu-Fan Li, and I have looked at what happens in three-dimensional flocks, which turns out to be a much harder problem, and that paper I can't give you yet because we're still in the process of writing it. And the process of writing it has reminded me of this quote by the American writer Philip Roth, and I'm sure any of you who have a work in progress know that this is true. Okay, so let me start out by talking about immortal flocks. So I'm going to start out. Again, probably many of you know more about these sorts of things than I do, but I'm going to start out by describing a particular microscopic model of the phenomenon of flocking. And that's a rather famous model in the field called the Wiesek model. The theory I'm going to describe would apply to a far larger class of systems than the VSEC model. I'm going to spell out exactly the class of systems for which I think it will apply. Essentially, it's any system that exhibits flocking when the underlying dynamics is both rotation invariant and local. And what got me into this field was the fact that two-dimensional flocking, the possibility of having a rotation invariant dynamics, local interactions, and yet getting an arbitrarily large system in which everyone moves in the same direction, should in principle be impossible. Or at least, if you only know about equilibrium systems, you would think that that would be impossible because it violates something called the Mirman-Wagner theorem, and I'll briefly describe that. And then I'll talk about how you formulate a continuum theory of this. I'm not going to get in for immortal flocks to the question of how the continuum theory gets you around the Mirman-Wagner theorem, because instead what I'll do is I'll switch at that point and talk about immortal flocks where the same thing happens and explain why it happens there. Okay, so I'm describing a particular microscopic algorithm here, the VSEC algorithm, just to give you a concrete example of a system, a simple system that exhibits flocking. So the VSEC algorithm is the following. You think of each individual creature as a point, and each point carries an arrow, and that arrow indicates the direction that particular creature is moving at that particular moment. Okay? And the dynamics of this motion is pretty simple. Each bird, I'm going to call each of these creatures a bird, tries to move in the direction of its neighbors. Now, the tricky thing here is because, as I've indicated by the arrows, different creatures are moving in different directions, your neighbors can change over time. So you need to think of a way to define neighbors that can take into account the fact that your neighbors may constantly be changing. And so VSEC came up with a very simple rule, which says that at each time, each creature draws a circle around itself of some radius, and every creature that's inside that radius is a neighbor. And what this creature, the central creature in black, does is he tries to move in the direction that all his neighbors are moving. Now, of course, his neighbors are moving in different directions, so what he does is he simply takes the average of the velocity vectors of all his neighbors and chooses that direction and moves in that direction at a speed v0. Okay? That's the VSEC algorithm. As I say, a lot of you have probably heard that before. There's one added wrinkle to this, and that wrinkle is where, for me, the really interesting questions come in. That wrinkle is you add noise. So what actually happens is that the creature doesn't move in the direction that's the average of his neighbors, but it's the average of his neighbors plus some noise. And the question, which may sound like one that's got a trivial answer, but which actually turns out to be very non-trivial, is in the presence of a non-zero noise, can a collection of creatures like this that's much bigger than this interaction radius R get into a coherent state in which everyone is moving in the same direction? It turns out that that's very that in principle would appear to be very difficult to do in two dimensions, but in fact, it can be done, and one of the mysteries in this field was, why is that? So anyway, that's the algorithm. This is a very simple algorithm. You can think of a million variants on this, and people have simulated many, many variants on this, but many of them exhibit this phenomenon that even in the presence of noise, you get this collective motion where everyone's moving on average in the same direction, and we want to understand why. Okay, so any questions about the algorithm? Okay. So the essential features of the algorithm, and these are the only features that are going to be required for the hydrodynamic theory I'm going to describe to actually work for this system, are, first of all, the interactions are local. They're short-ranged in space, and they're short-ranged in time. Okay? Short-ranged in space I've already defined, so you imagine that interaction range over which you define your neighbors is much, much smaller than your entire flock. Okay? Short-ranged in time means the creatures don't have any long-term memory. So you may be able to remember for a time step or two that that's the direction you were originally moving, but then you eventually forget. So the only thing that can keep you moving in that direction is if your neighbors keep moving in that direction. Okay, collective effects, in other words. Okay, so the interactions are local, short range in space and time. We want to consider ferromagnetic interactions, by which I simply mean that the creatures want to move in the same direction as their neighbors rather than, say, in the opposite direction to their neighbors. You could imagine trying to study a flock of contrarians in which everyone wants to move in the opposite direction to the direction everyone else is moving, but that would be a very different system, and that's not what I want to talk about here. Okay, so I'm limiting myself to ferromagnetic interactions. It's very important, it turns out, that the birds keep moving. Okay, and I'll explain in more detail why that's so important in a minute, and I want to consider situations in which they're making errors. And what we want to know is whether those errors will destroy the order or not. Okay, So you can summarize these requirements by a set of symmetries and conservation laws. And what I would claim is that any algorithm you can cook up that satisfies the following symmetries and conservation laws will be described by the hydrodynamic theory I'm going to present to you. So what are they? Now, this is where it gets a bit tricky. In condensed matter physics, we've learned over many years that there are two different aspects and two different ways in which symmetry plays a role. The first symmetries you have to specify are what are the symmetries of the underlying dynamics of your system. But that's not sufficient, because frequently in nature it happens that you have a system that has some underlying symmetry, but the system goes into a state which breaks that symmetry spontaneously. Okay? And that's what happens when you have a flock. Okay? So in the first column here, I'm listing the symmetries of the underlying dynamics. For example, the symmetries of the Vsec algorithm that I just described. It's translation invariant. The rules apply are the same no matter where you are in space. It's also rotation invariant. If you think about that rule for a minute, there's nothing in that rule that picks out a particular direction and says something special is going to happen in that direction versus some other direction. So we have rotation invariants. What that rule doesn't have, and this is an absence that I'm going to restrict myself to for the balance of my talk, is it does not have Galilean invariants. Galilean invariants just means that the dynamics looks the same in all reference frames. And that's not true here. It's clearly not true for the Vsec algorithm because there's a special frame, namely the frame in which everybody is moving at that speed, V0. Okay? So that dynamics is not Galilean invariant, and there are many physical situations in which dynamics is not Galilean invariant. If you had a mass of bacteria moving across this table, there'd be a special reference frame, namely the frame of reference of the table. And in particular, in terms of conservation laws, what that means is that the momentum of that swarm of bacteria is not conserved because they can transfer momentum to the table. Okay? So that's the class of systems I want to consider. That's the underlying dynamics. What about the state the system goes into? Well, I want to consider states in which translation invariance is still preserved. So that means if you look at the flock, over time, the average density is a constant. Okay, it doesn't change from place to place in space. So what the flock is not doing is, for example, forming some kind of flying crystal where everybody locks into a set of lattice positions and then that lattice just moves along. You should think of it more as a moving fluid. Okay, and a fluid has the property that its mean density is constant everywhere. But the flock definitely breaks rotation invariance. Right? If you have a million birds in here and they're all going that way, you can observe, just by sitting here, a big difference between that direction and the directions perpendicular to it. Okay? So even though the underlying dynamics is rotation invariant, when you form a flock, that is a state with a non-zero average velocity, you've explicitly broken that rotation invariance. Okay? And of course, you still have no Galilean invariance because you didn't have any Galilean invariance in the underlying dynamics. So this specifies the class of systems that I want to consider. The underlying dynamics have all these symmetries, the phase has has translation invariance, but not rotation invariance. And because it has no rotation invariance, it'll have a non-zero average speed. Okay, so those are the symmetries. The other thing you need to specify the hydrodynamics is the conservation laws. Now, for this part of the talk, there's going to be one conservation law, and that's number density. The total number of birds is going to be conserved during the process of this motion. Okay, in the second part of my talk, I'm going to remove that restriction, and that's going to lead to different dynamics. What we're not going to have in any part of this talk is momentum conservation, and that's for the reason I just described. You imagine these creatures are moving over some kind of substrate. They can lose momentum to the substrate, or they can gain momentum from the substrate, and so momentum is not conserved. If you read the literature in this field, people will often talk about dry active systems versus wet active systems, and what these two terms refer to is precisely the question of whether or not momentum is conserved. And for some reason, dry has come to mean momentum is not conserved, and wet has come to mean that momentum is conserved. And there's a history behind that, but it's a bit confusing. But if you're in the field, you get used to it, and everybody knows that. So in the language of this field, I'm talking about dry active matter. Okay? All right. So what happens if you just run a simulation of something like the Vsec algorithm? What happens is something which at first glance seems very trivial. You get order. Okay? So if you start at t equals 0 with all your birds in random positions with their arrows pointing in random directions, well, obviously, that's a state with an average velocity of 0, and that's a state that is rotation invariant. Any direction is equally as likely to be a direction a bird is moving in as any other direction. Then you run VSX algorithm for a long time, and what you get to is a state where everyone's moving in the same direction. Okay? So, and that, of course, you can see if you add up all these vectors, you're going to get something that's non-zero, and so that's a state with a non-zero average velocity. And if you don't know any statistical mechanics, and you look at that, you say, well, why are you surprised? You built an algorithm that tended to make things move in the same direction, and they all moved in the same direction. What's the big deal? And the big deal, and this is something that VSEC emphasized when he first did these simulations, is that if you do know some statistical mechanics, and you remember that this is a simulation in two dimensions, then you should say that this is impossible. And the reason is that in two-dimensional statistical mechanics, we have a theorem called the Merman-Wagner theorem. Now, you know, in physics, you don't have a lot of theorems. So if you have something that you're sure enough that that you're willing to call it a theorem, you're really surprised if it turns out not to be true, right? And here's an example where something, the Merman-Wagner theorem, turns out not to be true. And that raises the horrible question, are birds smarter than nerds? Do these active things know something that we physicists don't know? That's right. Landau and Pyles knew it at least a generation before Merman and Wagner did, but they didn't prove it. So in those days, it was called the Landau-Pyles instability. Yeah. But it wasn't called the Landau-Pyles theorem because they didn't elevate it to the status of the theorem. They didn't dot the I's and cross the T's. But it's really the same thing. It is just the Landau-Pyles instability, the thing that was known about before any of us, even me, were born. Yeah. But and you can understand, right? And basically, Merman and Wagner got to put their names on it because they took the arguments of Landau and Pyles and made them rigorous. They showed that Landau and Pyles' calculation gives you an upper bound on the order, and since it predicts no order in two dimensions, that means there must be no order in two dimensions. Oh, incidentally, if you read Merman's paper on this, it's a really beautiful paper because it starts out saying, you know, there's been some question about whether one can rigorously prove that there's no order in two dimensions. Full stop. And then he says, in this paper, I will not only prove this theorem, but I will prove it in a single sentence. Full stop. And then he starts, whereas, and he writes an equation, and then there's a semicolon, and then it goes on, and there's semicolons and colons and commas and parentheses and so on, but no full stop until four pages later you get to the end. It's perfectly clear. You can read it effortlessly, but if you read it carefully, you realize it's all done in one sentence. And then there's a few sentences at the end where he gives the acknowledgments and so on. Great paper. And that's why it's called the Merman-Wagner theorem, really. Okay, but you're right. It's an old idea. It's something that people have understood since the 1930s, absolutely. Okay, so how can this happen, and how can we understand it? So, as I said, when VSEC was going around giving talks about this, and I was lucky enough to hear one of the first talks he gave about this, he was deliberately trying to bait the audience into working on this. So when he gave this talk at IBM when I was there, he said, you guys are all statistical physicists. You know this should be impossible. And yet here it is. It's happening. Can you explain this? And Yuhai Tu and I walked out of the room and thought, we were just so provoked by this. We were so angry about this that we went out and tried to explain it. Okay. But before I do that, I want to explain why we think this is so surprising. Okay. And the way to understand it is by thinking about an experiment that's done every year at the American Physical Society March meeting. I imagine this is also, there's an equivalent meeting in France. I know there's an equivalent meeting in Germany. And the experiment is the following. So you have this meeting, 20,000 physicists descend on this city that none of them have ever been to before. And you have sessions all day, and at the end of the sessions, all 20,000 physicists gather in the lobby of the hotel, and they want to go to dinner. Okay? The problem is that none of them have ever been to the city before. They don't know where the restaurants are. They don't know which ones are good and which ones are not good. So they know they're just going to pick some random restaurant to go to. But, of course, you don't want to start walking until you know where you're going. So what people do is they gather in the lobby of this hotel, and everybody just points in a random direction and says, why don't we go that way and try to find a place to go to dinner? But then, of course, you want to cooperate with everybody else, so you look around at your neighbors, you see they're all pointing in different directions, and you say, okay, on average, my neighbors are pointing mostly in that direction, so I'll point that way. And in the meantime, your neighbors are doing the same thing, and they're changing the direction they point. And if you think about this, you could imagine modeling this process by something almost exactly like the VSEC algorithm that I described earlier. Okay? It's got all the same ingredients. It's got locality, because you can't see all 20,000 physicists. You can only see the few that are nearest to you. It's got a tendency to align, because you're trying to cooperate with your neighbors. And it's got errors. Right? Even though we're smarter than birds, we're not perfect. And so I may try to point in the direction that's the average of my neighbors, but I'm going to make some mistake. Okay? And so you can imagine running an algorithm that's just like the VSEC algorithm with one crucial difference. Because we're smart, we don't start walking until everybody's pointing in the same direction. So what we do instead of doing the VSEC algorithm is instead of being flockers, we're pointers. We just all stand in one place and try to point in the same direction as their neighbors. Has anybody here ever been to the March meeting? American Physical Society March meeting. So you know what happens, right? You never get dinner. And the reason you never get dinner is you never wind up with everybody pointing in the same direction. And the reason for that is the Merman-Wagner theorem. Okay? And the Merman-Wagner theorem can be boiled down to the following. You can say, let's run this dynamics for a long time and ask, in the steady state, what's the typical fluctuation in the direction that a given person is pointing? Of course, the average fluctuation is zero, so you look at the mean squared fluctuation, and what you find is that the mean squared fluctuation goes like the mean squared error that you make. That's this parameter delta. Well, that doesn't sound too bad, because you might hope to make that number small, but it goes like that times the logarithm of the linear extent of the system. And the problem with that is that, of course, as the system size goes to infinity, this logarithm goes to infinity, and what that means is that no matter how small delta is, the mean squared fluctuation in the direction you point is going to go to infinity, which means you're going to be equally likely to be pointing in any direction, which means if you look at the ensemble as a whole, people are equally likely to be pointing in all directions. There's no coherence, there's no order, and you don't get dinner. And you don't develop you don't break rotation invariance here. Okay? And that's the Merman-Wagner theorem. It's just that result. And as Jacques pointed out, historically, this sort of calculation was first done by Landau and Piles back in the 1930s. You have to make some approximations to do that calculation, but it was later proven that those approximations set a rigorous upper bound on the order and tell you, therefore, that in two dimensions, you can't have any long-range order. So you can't develop a state in which the average of all these vectors is non-zero in an infinitely large system. Okay? So if you know that, then if someone comes along and tells you, I'm going to take exactly this algorithm and make one tiny change, the only change is that instead of telling everybody to point in the same direction, I'm going to tell everyone to walk in the same direction. And then they can do it. They can all line up and walk in the same direction perfectly well. And that's very puzzling if you think about it. Right? And so that was the puzzle that Yuhai and I set out to explain. Okay, so the short answer to how you get around the Merman-Wagner theorem is if you read the fine print of this very long sentence that David Merman wrote out, somewhere in one of the subordinate clauses of that sentence, it says equilibrium systems. And if you're moving, of course, you're not in equilibrium. You have to have an internal energy source that's overcoming friction to keep you moving. Okay? So the coward's way out of this contradiction with the Merman-Wagner theorem is to say that, well, a flocking system is a non-equilibrium system, so the theorem doesn't apply. And while that's true, it doesn't explain anything. We wanted to actually understand what it is about motion that makes it possible to get around this theorem, which applies if you don't move but just point. Okay? So that was the goal. So the way we did this was to formulate a continuum theory of this system. And I should emphasize, I'm still talking about immortal flocks here, so we still have number conservation. Okay, so the idea of a continuum theory is it's too hard to think about 100,000 or a million or a billion individuals and keep track of all of them as they move through space. Even if you could do that, even if you could solve one particular system of many, many particles, it'd be very hard to figure out what happens if you change the dynamics in some way. You know, the Vsec algorithm is one of an infinity of possible different algorithms that are local and rotation invariant. It's hard, if you just solve one of those, to know what would change if you changed some details of the microscopic model. In other words, it's hard to figure out what's universal versus what's specific to a particular system. So we thought that in approaching this problem, we were in a position similar to what Navier and Stokes were in back in, by the way, I've got this date wrong. I recently discovered that this year is the 200th anniversary of the birth of Navier. So in 1922, he was only 1822, he was only 3 years old, so I don't think he formulated the equation then. He was a smart guy, but he wasn't that smart. But anyway, sometime in back in the 19th century, these two guys, one English, one French, oddly enough, formulated a description of fluid mechanics which was so good that it's what we use today, almost 200 years later. Okay? And it's pretty amazing because in that day, they didn't have any theory of atoms and molecules. I'm not even sure whether Navier and Stokes thought that fluids were made out of atoms and molecules or thought they were just some continuous stuff that filled all space. Right? They certainly didn't have statistical physics, right? I mean, Boltzmann hadn't even been born yet, much less committed suicide. And they didn't have a computer. They couldn't do a computer simulation or anything like that. They didn't have iPads or iPods to make them feel better about how difficult this problem was. Nonetheless, they wrote down these two very simple equations you can write down in two lines, and those equations explain all the fluid mechanics for all fluids. They describe oil coming up out of an oil well at the bottom of the North Sea. They describe the atmosphere. They describe water. They describe honey. All these different fluids can be described by this very simple system of equations. So how'd they do it? It seemed to Yuhai and I that it would be a good idea for us to try to emulate them. So the first thing they did was they took a continuum approach. They didn't think about the trajectories of individual particles that make up the fluid. They thought instead about continuous fields that filled all space. And the fields they used are the same ones that we decided to use for a description of the flock. They were a local density field. So you imagine this density of birds at every point in space, or at every time t, and that evolves over time. The other field you use in fluid mechanics and that we use to describe a flock is a velocity field, which again is defined at every point in space and evolves with time. Okay? So those are the variables we use. Now, this picture is clearly only makes sense if you're looking at length scales that are very large compared to, in a fluid, the interatomic distance, in a flock, the interbird distance, and it only makes sense if you're looking at time scales very large compared to the time scales of the collisions of the individual particles. Because only on such length scales and time scales is it reasonable to think of it as a continuous evolving system. Now, you can look at this limitation as a bug, or you can look at it as a feature. I look at it as a feature. That is, I think of this, the fact that we're looking at long length and time scales, as a good thing, because what that means is that we can make some simplifications in our hydrodynamic equations. Before I get into that, I want to talk about why we chose only these fields. Okay? And in particular, right, so it makes sense that we use these fields, but why should we use only these fields? And this is something I felt like I had to talk about, because frequently I give this talk in front of biologists, and invariably, the biologists, of course, know much more about living systems than I do, and invariably, at this point in the talk, a biologist will raise his hand, and he'll say, what about Gezorenplatte? He doesn't say Gezorenplatte, but he says some word that's equally unintelligible to me. I have no idea what he's talking about, but I know that I have to be careful, because this guy's probably been studying Gezorenplatte for his entire life. Right? So I can't just tell him, oh, Gezorenplatte is unimportant. And that's not really the right answer anyway. The point is that there are many other quantities other than the density and the velocity that you could imagine thinking about, and you might wonder why we don't have to include those in a hydrodynamic description. And the reason is that in a hydrodynamic description, we only have to include variables that are slow. And by slow, I mean something very, very specific. I mean that if I look at a distortion in whatever continuous field I'm talking about that takes place over some large length scale, as I take that length scale to infinity, the time scale on which that fluctuation relaxes also goes to infinity. There are very, very few fields that actually do that in any given system, simply because if you have a system with many degrees of freedom and it's very complicated and there are lots of interactions, almost anything you can think of can relax back very quickly. There's just a lot of processes going on that'll do that. So only a field that's got a very good reason not to relax quickly will relax slowly. Okay? So you have to ask, why are these two fields slow? Well, for the density, and again, I'm still talking about immortal flocks, density relaxes slowly because it's conserved, right? Because particle number is conserved. And that makes it a slow variable. Velocity, okay, now here it gets a bit tricky. If you know a little fluid mechanics, you'll say velocity is a slow variable in the Navier-Stokes equations because of momentum conservation. But I'm not talking about a system with momentum conservation here. I'm talking about a system that's moving over a substrate. The momentum can change very quickly due to frictional interaction with the substrate. So why am I keeping the velocity field as a slow variable? For me, it's because the velocity field is a broken symmetry variable and it's a Goldstone mode. And I'm going to elaborate on that now. First of all, why are conserved variables slow? Well, that's pretty simple. So here's a region. Say this is a region of the flock that's got a higher than average density. Okay, as you can see, pretty dense. Right? And it's got some large spatial extent L. Okay? How can that density relax? Well, if the birds are immortal, if they aren't being born and they aren't dying, then whatever birds are here, they're going to be somewhere forever. So the only way to get them out of this region of spatial extent L is to move them out. And since they can only move at a finite speed, as the size of the system L goes to infinity, the time it's going to take to remove birds from this is also going to go to infinity. And so the density is going to be a slow variable. Okay? So that's pretty simple. What about velocity? So remember, velocity is not a conserved quantity in this system, but it's a Goldstone mode. And what I'm going to give you here is a poor man's derivation of Goldstone's theorem. Okay? So imagine you had a flock in which, in one part of the flock, everybody was moving to the right, and some large distance L away, everybody was moving slightly below that path. You know, so these guys are all moving east, these guys are all moving southeast. How can this distortion relax back to a state where they're all moving in the same direction? Well, remember, the underlying dynamics is rotation invariant. So these guys over here are locally just as happy as these guys over here. They're all moving in the same direction as their neighbors. So the only way these guys can find out that they should be moving east rather than southeast is for information to be transmitted from these guys in the east to these guys in the southeast over this intervening distance L. But the interactions are local. So to get from here to here, this bird has to talk to the bird here, that bird has to talk to the bird here, and so on. That process takes time. That time is going to grow without bound as the distance L goes to infinity. And so this distortion is also going to have a lifetime that's going to go to infinity as L goes to infinity. Therefore, we have to keep the velocity field, even though velocity is not actually conserved, because we're talking about a spontaneously broken symmetry in which a particular direction is picked out in an underlying dynamics that does not have a particular direction built in. Okay, is that clear? That's Goldstone's theorem. All right, so that explains why we keep these fields. That explains why these fields are slow. What about the Gazorin-Platt field? What about all the other fields in the system? Well, those fields are going to be fast. And so what's going to happen with those fields is that you have some local density and some local velocity that's evolving slowly. All the other variables are going to evolve quickly. So they're going to quickly go to whatever values are optimal given the local density and the local velocity. So the way we describe that is we say the fast fields are enslaved to the slow fields. So when the biologist asks you, what about the Gazorin-Platt field, you say, I include that in my equations of motion, but then I say the Gazorin-Platt field is determined by the local density and velocity. I plug in that expression for the Gazorin-Platt field, and I get an equation of motion for the velocity and the density that only depends on the velocity and the density. It's completely closed. And I found my experience is that that usually works. That makes the biologist happy. Okay, so that's what's going on. Anything you're worried about that's fast is going to be enslaved to the variables that are slow. I'm going to give you an explicit example of this when I talk about Malthusian flocks, where number density is not conserved, so density becomes a fast variable, and I'll explicitly do this elimination. I'll show you how the density gets enslaved to the velocity, and you can eliminate it and get an equation just for the velocity. Okay? All right. So that's the story. So once you have all of this, now all you have to do, this is just saying in equations what I just said in words, when you don't have a conserved density, then the density just becomes a function of the local velocity. Okay, so for immortal flocks, we've now identified the fields we need to consider. We still need equations of motion, right? We still haven't done the hard work. What are the equations of motion for this field? How do we get them? So there's two approaches. One is to start with the microscopic dynamics, like the VSEC algorithm, and do some kind of arduous statistical mechanical coarse graining of those equations and get equations of motion for these two guys. I don't like that approach for a number of reasons. The biggest one is that it's very, very hard work, and I'm lazy. Okay? The second one is that you have to do it over again every time you consider a different set of microscopic rules. And the third one is that it's so hard that even the people who are really good at it and are willing to work really hard have to make uncontrolled approximations in the derivation. So my attitude is, if I'm going to have to make uncontrolled approximations anyway, I might as well take the other approach to deriving the equations of motions, which has a long and proud history in theoretical physics, which is you make them up. So that's what Yuhaitu and I did. We just went to my blackboard after VSEC's talk, and we spent a few hours writing down terms and crossing things out and throwing in other things, and we eventually came up with a set of equations that we liked. Now, of course, if you're just making something up and you don't apply any rules at all, there's infinitely many terms you can write down. So you have to sort of pare things down somehow. And so what we did was we introduced some rules. And we didn't actually introduce these. These are the standard rules for writing down hydrodynamics. So how do you write down hydrodynamics? Well, hydrodynamics, to me, means looking at a system at long length scales and long time scales. Okay? Remember, I mentioned that earlier. This whole picture only makes sense at long length and time scales. You can use that because it says that if you're writing down terms in your equations of motion, you only need to keep terms that are lowest order in space and time derivatives. Because if things are varying very slowly in space and very slowly in time, then higher derivatives will be smaller than lower derivatives. So we only need to keep the terms that involve the lowest order space and time derivatives. And that eliminates multiple infinities of possible terms in our equations, which is good, because we want to make the equations as simple as possible. The other thing we want to do is we want to assume that the fluctuations are small. Now, we're not guaranteed that that's going to be true. The Merman-Wagner theorem shows that in a two-dimensional equilibrium system, the fluctuations are never small. If you have any noise, you're going to get essentially infinite fluctuations. But we're hoping that we're going to be able, that for the non-equilibrium flock, you'll be able to get an ordered state, and so at least sometimes that ordered state will have small fluctuations, and so we'll write down our equations to lowest order in the fluctuations. That eliminates a huge infinity of possible terms. And then finally, the thing, so by fluctuations, I just mean departures of the density from the mean density and departures of the velocity from the mean velocity. Here's where things get a little bit tricky. We're not assuming that the velocity is small. We're just assuming that the fluctuations of the velocity around this mean value are small. That unfortunately means you have to include more terms than you would otherwise like. You have to include terms that are higher order in velocity, but low order in changes in the velocity or in fluctuations in the velocity. So the equations get a little more complicated than I would like, but you have to live with that because that's the sort of state you're trying to describe. Okay, the final rule is the one that really saves your bacon and really makes it possible to write down a fairly simple set of equations, and that's that even though you're not deriving your equations from an underlying dynamics, you know there is some underlying dynamics, and you know that underlying dynamics has certain symmetries and certain conservation laws. So the equations you're going to make up for the density and the velocity have to respect those symmetries and those conservation laws. When you apply these rules and write down everything you can think of, well, if you did this for the Navier-Stokes equation, for a simple fluid, for which you'd have to add one other symmetry, which is Galilean invariance, you find out that the only thing you can write down are the Navier-Stokes equations. There's nothing else that's allowed by all these criteria. So by the same logic, the equation that Yuhai Tu and I were going to write down, assuming we thought of every possible term, is also going to be the only possible thing you can have for a system with these symmetries and conservation laws. So what do you get? Well, you get two equations because you have two fields. You've got a velocity equation. Oh, sorry, this is the Navier-Stokes equation. I'll skip this. Okay, so what do you get when you do this for a flock? Well, you need two equations because you have two fields. You need a density equation of motion and a velocity equation of motion. The density equation of motion, I think most people here have seen before, right? That's just the continuity equation. I just want to emphasize for the second part of my talk that what this says in the context of a flock is that birds are not being born or dying. Their number is conserved. Okay. When I start to allow birth and death, then the right-hand side here is not going to be zero anymore. In fact, what it's going to be is the difference between the local birth rate and the local death rate. Okay. But for immortal flocks, this side is just zero. So that gives you an equation for the density. You'll notice, of course, in the continuity equation, the density is coupled to the velocity. The velocity then has its own equation of motion, and if you write down all the terms that are allowed by the symmetries that and conservation laws that I described, this is what you get. Okay. So I just want to compare this to the Navier-Stokes equation. All of the terms that are not highlighted here are also present in the Navier-Stokes equation. Then in addition, in our system, you get the terms that I've highlighted. So let me go through these. The first thing you get is, as in the Navier-Stokes equation, you get this V dot grad V term. That's called a convective derivative. And if you're not familiar with fluid mechanics, I'll just tell you that that reflects the fact that I may have a steady state velocity field. I could have the air in this room moving in a way that didn't change with time. But if I was a small insect being carried along by that fluid flow, I might accelerate because the airspeed might be very low over here and might be higher over here. So if I'm an insect being carried along by that flow, I'll accelerate as I move along. This term reflects that acceleration. Okay? In the Navier-Stokes equation, its coefficient has to be 1. That's required by Galilean invariance, it turns out. This equation will only be the same in all frames of reference if that coefficient is 1. I don't have Galilean invariance, so that term doesn't have to be 1, but it also doesn't have to be 0. So it's there, and we have an extra parameter, lambda 1. This lambda 2 and lambda 3 terms, they're like this convective derivative. They have two velocities and one spatial gradient, but the way the velocities and the spatial gradient tensor indices are contracted with each other are slightly different. Okay. Both of these terms violate Galilean invariants, but we don't have Galilean invariants, so we're allowed to do that. So we get those terms. These terms are the ones that really make the system active. So let's look at the first term first. It's just, if we only had this term, we'd say dTv is alpha v, and you've all seen that before. When you took freshman physics and you wanted to write down a simple model for an object moving over a surface with friction, you wrote down dTv is minus some drag coefficient times the velocity, right? So that's a familiar thing. So this is just like that, except you'll notice I seem to have forgotten the minus sign. That's not a mistake. In an active system, in a system of living creatures with an internal energy source, alpha can actually be positive. And it turns out that's the case in which you can get flocking, because the first requirement of flocking is that everybody move. And if alpha is positive, everybody will move. If you start with a system in which the velocities are all initially very, very small, but you have a positive alpha, everybody will accelerate in the direction they're moving, and the speed will go up. Now, even if the flock is made out of clones of Usain Bolt, they can't go at an infinite speed, so the velocity has to saturate, and that's what this higher order term does. Eventually, you reach some maximum speed at which you can go, and then you stop accelerating. So that's what these terms represent. So if I made alpha negative, I'd just be making a model for some inert material moving over a frictional surface, but by making it positive, I make it active. And this, by the way, is a common theme in active matter. A lot of hydrodynamic equations for active matter look just like the hydrodynamic equations for equilibrium matter, but with the coefficients having the wrong sign. And that reflects the energy input that can happen in an active system. Okay, so that's these terms. This term, so you have a, in the equation of motion, you have a pressure term, just like you have in the Navier-Stokes equation. This says that if I have high density here and low density here, there'll be a tendency of the creatures to accelerate from the high density region to the low density region. And that's very familiar from ordinary fluid mechanics. This term is an anisotropic version of that. Since my system is going to go into a state that's going to pick a particular direction by picking a particular velocity, there's nothing that says, there's no fundamental principle of physics that says that if I have a gradient in the density that points in the direction the flock is moving, that the response to that is going to be the same as if I have a gradient of the density perpendicular to the direction the flock is moving. And so to allow for that possible difference, I add this extra term. Okay, this is just like the bulk viscosity term in the Navier-Stokes equation. This is like the shear viscosity term in the Navier-Stokes equation. This is a term that does the same thing for viscosities that this term did for pressure forces. It says, if my flock is moving in that direction, I can have a different viscosity for that direction than for that direction. And finally, last wrinkle is I have a noise term, and that reflects the errors. Okay? So these are the equations that Tu and I wrote down, and to make a long story very, very short, if you solve these equations, taking into account the nonlinearities, you find that there is no Merman-Wagner theorem in two dimensions, and in fact, you can get long-range order. Rather than go into that for immortal flocks, I'll go to the second half of my talk and explain how the same thing comes about for mortal flocks, flocks with birth and death. And that's what I'm going to switch to now. Okay. All right, so now I want to move on to Malthusian flocks. So this is just flocks in which birth and death is happening on the same time scale as the motion. Here's what I'm going to tell you, just an outline of this part of the talk. So let's get to it. So I've already given you this example of the mitotic spindle. Probably a better example, and one that I need to borrow some pictures from Jacques and Jean-Francois, is a tissue. Right? A tissue of cells that are reproducing and dying while they also can move is another example of a Malthusian flock. So why do I call this a Malthusian flock? Well, I call it a Malthusian flock in homage to one of my favorite late 19th and early 20th century natural philosophers, as they called them in those days, Thomas Malthus, who, in his most famous work, An Essay on the Principle of Population, wrote the following. So he was concerned about the possibility that the world was going to become overpopulated and everyone was going to wind up living on the brink of starvation. And this is what he wrote. I'll let you read that. I won't read this out. I just want to call your attention to a couple of facts. First of all, this is very florid prose. And if you tried to submit a physical review letter with this sort of prose in it, the editors wouldn't even send it out to referees. They'd reject it out of hand. You can't publish this sort of thing in scientific, not even in PNAS. You just can't publish this sort of thing anymore. So if Malthus was publishing today, I think what he would say is this, which basically summarizes all that florid prose on the previous slide. So what I imagine is that this g of rho here is the difference between the birth rate and the death rate at some point. Okay? And Malthus's notion was that if your density is very low, so you have a low population, well, there's enough food to feed everybody. So everybody has 10, 12, 15 kids, and all those kids thrive and survive to adulthood, and they all have 10, 12, 15 kids, and the population goes zooming up. Okay? Eventually they die, of course, just of old age, but they don't die of starvation, they don't die before they have more children, so the population grows very rapidly. Eventually, you start to get, like England was starting to get at the time Malthus was writing, all the available farmland is taken, and you can just barely support your family on the land that's available. And so the death rate starts to go up, basically because your kids starve. Okay? And eventually, the population growth stops, and you settle down to a steady state density rho zero, and this density is a horrible place to be, because it means you still have your 10 or 12 children, and all but two of them die before they get to reproduce. Right? So you have a horrible life, your children have a horrible life, and he thought we should do something about this. What he thought we should do was birth control, which was a very good idea. The problem was that in the late 18th century, the only way to practice birth control was to not have sex, and the idea just didn't catch on. Now we have better ways, of course, and we've been able to get around this problem. Anyway. So that was Malthus's idea. And of course, the flip side of this is if you, say, import a bunch of people, so you now have a population density higher than the steady state density rho zero, then not even two of your children survive to have children of their own. Fewer than two of them survive. And so the population over time goes down until you settle down to the same steady state horrible density where you're just living on the knife edge between birth and death. Okay? So that was Malthus's idea. My idea was, combine this dynamics with the dynamics of flocking. Okay? So that's what we're going to do. Okay? So we're going to start with the same equation of motion for the velocity that I had for immortal flocks. That equation has a density in it, but now we're going to close the equation by changing the equation of motion for the density. We'll still have the continuity-like term on the left-hand side, but on the right-hand side we'll have this birth and death term that I just wrote down. Okay? That's the model. So what do we do with this? Well, let's look at this Malthusian form of g of rho again. It turns out only two parameters matter. What is this equilibrium density rho zero? That's one parameter. And the other one is the slope of this tangent. The reason those are the only two things that matter is that any departure of the density from this mean density is going to relax back very quickly to the equilibrium density, so you're never going to see fluctuations that are very far away from the equilibrium density. So even though in principle we have to specify this whole function, all we really have to do is specify rho zero and the slope of this tangent. The slope of this tangent, if you think about it for a minute and you look at my equation of motion, has to have the dimensions of an inverse time. So that's a characteristic relaxation time for the density. It's probably comparable to the lifetime of a creature or the inverse birth rate or something like that, some combination of those things. So for human beings, this would be 80 years. For the mitotic spindle, it would be 15 minutes. Okay? So those are the parameters of the model. Okay. Now, you might think the density just drops out of the problem altogether, but that's not quite true. And the reason is immigration. Right? The country I'm from, the US, has actually had a slightly negative g of rho for most of my lifetime. And yet there are now twice as many people in the US as there were when I was born, and that's because of immigration. Okay, even though we've restricted it and we've got lunatic politicians who don't want to let people in, people have still been immigrating and the population has gone up. So how does that play into this evolution equation for the density? Well, we have an immigration term. That's this divergence of the current term. We've got this birth and death term. And so if we assume the density is close to the steady state density, then we can expand this function around that point where g of rho is zero. That's the first order expansion with this relaxation time tau in it. And now suppose we're considering a velocity field that's evolving very slowly compared to this time tau. And it will evolve very slowly because it's a hydrodynamic variable, because it's associated with a broken symmetry. Well then, on the time scale of tau, the velocity field is a constant in time. And so the evolution of the velocity field will be very slow compared to the evolution of the density. So we'll be looking at processes where time derivatives, in particular the time derivative of the density, will be very small compared to departures in the density divided by tau. So what I'm trying to argue is that we can erase that time derivative term if we're looking at slowly evolving velocity fields. And if you do that, then you'll notice that suddenly we no longer have an equation of motion for the density, we just have an equation for the density. That is, you give me, I need to make one further approximation here. If I assume the density is close to the steady state density, then I can replace the rho in here with rho zero. And now if you look at this equation, this is an instantaneous equation for the density. You give me the, any position-dependent velocity field at a given time, and I can tell you exactly what the density is at that point in space at that time. I don't need to solve an equation of motion for it. And this is what I called earlier in the talk enslavement. The density field is no longer acting like a dynamical variable. It's just locally determined by what the velocity field is determined doing locally. Okay? The physics, and in fact, so if I now take this equation and solve for the density field, I get that it's just the steady state density times a correction, which goes like this relaxation time, times the divergence of the local velocity. And that's what I mean by the density being enslaved to the velocity field. You don't need to tell me the velocity field separately. You don't need to give me the density field separately. You tell me the velocity field, I immediately tell you the density field. Okay? So once I have this condition on the density, I can go back to my, the physical picture of this is just, here's a velocity field which has div dot v negative, okay? So you have material flowing in to this region, and in such a region, the density is going to go up. So what's happening here is creatures are constantly moving into the region that I've encircled. The density has gone above the steady state density, so creatures are dying in here faster than they're being born, but the difference between the death rate and the birth rate is being made up for by immigration. And so the density in here is staying fixed by the constant immigration of things due to the non-zero divergence of the velocity. Okay? Does that make sense? All right. So we can use that to eliminate the density everywhere it appears in this equation of motion. Okay? And you can see what's going to happen. If I say the density is proportional to the divergence of V, and I say the pressure is proportional to the change in the density, which is it is if the changes in the density are small, then this term is going to become the gradient of the divergence of the velocity, and that looks just like this term over here. So effectively, what used to be the pressure term and be a very important component of the dynamics just becomes some finite renormalization of the shear viscosity, of the bulk viscosity. Okay? And so we do that, we just erase that term and we replace this with a new effective bulk viscosity, and that's basically it. Okay? And now we can take that equation of motion and expand it in fluctuations. How are we doing here? Oh, not too bad. Okay. So remember, I'm trying to look at a state in which the whole flock on average is moving in some direction at some speed v0. So locally, due to fluctuations, due to errors, you're going to have a velocity field which will be different from v0. I can write that velocity field as the mean velocity field plus a perturbation. That perturbation has a component along the mean velocity field that I call u parallel, and a perpendicular component that I call u perp, and I can expand in u parallel and u perp. U parallel winds up being a fast variable. And if you think about that, that makes sense. Imagine you're out on the streets of Paris and you're running from your home in a distant arrondissement into the center of the city. You're running at a speed you're comfortable at, right? And then a demonstration starts behind you, so you start running a little faster. But you can't keep running at that higher speed for very long because you get too tired, right? You were running at your maximum speed before, now you're running a bit too fast. So any fluctuation along your direction of motion is going to decay rapidly because of your intrinsic dynamics. So this u parallel is going to become a fast variable, and I can eliminate that from the dynamics in a way very similar to the way I just eliminated the density. So all I'm left with when I'm done is an equation of motion for this perpendicular field, which is the Goldstone mode for this problem. Okay? So if you do that, you get an equation of motion which looks remarkably simple. Okay? And that's it. Okay? And the nice thing about this equation of motion is that almost every term in it is linear, which makes it much easier to deal with. Okay? You've got the time derivative of u perp itself. You've got these three terms, which are effectively like viscous damping terms. The only complication compared to the Navier-Stokes equation is that they're anisotropic. You have a different viscosity for a motion perpendicular to the direction of flock motion than for parallel to the direction of flock motion. You've got a noise which is entering linearly. The only nonlinearity in the whole equation is this convective-like nonlinearity. That's the only thing we have to deal with, and that makes life a lot simpler. Okay, so what do you do with this? Well, the first thing you do with an equation of motion like this is to cross your fingers and hope that you can ignore the nonlinear terms altogether. right? Because then it becomes really simple. So let's see if we can do that. Well, you can actually figure out whether or not you can ignore the nonlinear term by counting on your fingers. So let's introduce some exponents to do this counting. Let's assume that the characteristic time scale in this system grows like its characteristic length scale to some power, and I'll call that power z, and that remains to be determined. Okay? That's typically called the dynamic exponent. Now, this is an anisotropic system. You see, directions parallel to flock motion, which I call x, and perpendicular to flock motion, which I very cleverly call perp, are different, so I need to specify which direction those length scales are in. I'm always going to choose to evaluate things compared to length scales in the perpendicular direction. Okay? So I'm going to assume that t scales like r perp to a power z. I'm going to assume that distances parallel to the direction of flock motion scale like distances perpendicular to that direction with an exponent zeta, which is called the anisotropy exponent for obvious reasons. And finally, how does the velocity field itself, this perpendicular velocity field, scale with length scale? I'm going to call that the exponent chi, the roughness exponent, and assume u perp scales like that. Okay? So now you can study this equation just by counting on your fingers. You can stick these scalings into every term in this equation and see how they behave with length scale or perp. Okay? So let's do that. The time derivative of u, well, that's like a u field, which goes like r perp to the chi, divided by a time. Time goes like r perp to the z. So this term goes like r perp to the chi minus z. Okay? Very simple. These two terms involve two perpendicular derivatives. So that's like dividing by two powers of r. So that gives you an r perp to the minus 2. And they go like a velocity field, which goes like r perp to the chi. So these terms go like r perp to the chi minus 2. This term goes like r perp to the chi minus 2 zeta because it's x derivatives here, not perp derivatives. Okay? That's all very simple. The most complicated thing is the force term, and I don't have time to get into that in detail, but we assume the force has white noise correlations, and so when you calculate its scaling, you have this annoying bookkeeping to do that you have to take into account the scaling of delta functions when you rescale their arguments. But you can do that, and it's really no more than counting on your fingers, but it takes a little more time than I have to explain here. If you do that, you find that this scales like r perp to a power that involves two of these three exponents, z and zeta. Okay, so now if you want to do a linear, if you want to believe that these linear terms are complete theory, that they describe everything, then you have to assume that all of these terms are comparable. And you see, that gives you, so here I've just recapped that scale, that power counting that I just did. If you assume that all these terms are comparable, okay, so let's assume that this time derivative term and these two perp derivative terms are comparable. That gives me an equation relating chi minus z and chi minus 2, and that has a very simple solution, which is z is 2. Which shouldn't surprise you. Basically, here we've got a time derivative, here we've got two perp derivatives, so this z equals 2 just says time scales like two perpendicular distances. It's just like a diffusion equation. Okay, so that's not a surprise. You can now balance these two terms. That gives you an equation relating chi minus 2 and chi minus 2 zeta, and that has the solution zeta equals 1. That also shouldn't surprise you. Here we had two perpendicular derivatives. Here we have two x derivatives. This says that x goes like perp. No big deal. Okay? The last balance is to balance the force term against, well, take your pick, any one of these terms that you like. Here I've chosen to balance the force term against these perpendicular gradient terms. That gives me a third equation relating z, zeta, and chi. Since I've already got z and zeta, I can figure out what chi is from this. The only reason I wanted to do this power counting is to show you that the value I get for chi is 2 minus d over 2, which you'll notice says that chi is 0 and d equals 2. And now comes the moment when you have to remember your first calculus class, when you were learning how to integrate powers. Right? When you integrate a power, you get a power that's 1 higher, with one exception, which is if the power is negative 1. Then you don't get a power 0, meaning a constant. You get a power 0, meaning a logarithm. And this 0 is nothing but the Merman-Wagner theorem. If you're more careful, you find that this doesn't say that that the velocity fluctuations scale like constants, but that they scale like the log of r perp, so they go to infinity when r perp goes to infinity, and that's just the Merman-Wagner theorem. So you can actually get the Merman-Wagner theorem just by counting on your fingers. All right. If this were the whole story, this would say that the Merman-Wagner theorem works in two dimensions and that this Malthusian flock has no long-range order. But in fact, it doesn't, because we haven't yet verified a posteriori that the neglect of this nonlinear term was valid. But now we can do that. We can use these scaling exponents and estimate how big this term is. How big is the nonlinear term? So let's do that. Okay? How does this term scale? It's got two powers of u. U scales like r perp to the chi. It's got one spatial gradient. That gives you a power of r perp to the minus 1. So this scales like r perp to the 2 chi minus 1. If you believe the linear theory, you believe we know what chi is. So, and what z, for that matter, well, you know, what everything is. So we can ask, what's the ratio of this nonlinear term to one of the linear terms in the equation? For example, the time derivative term. And if you compute that ratio, you get this combination. It's just counting on your fingers. And if you plug in the values of the exponents that I got in the previous transparency, you'll find that this combination of exponents goes like r perp to the 4 minus d over 2. And now you realize that not only is two dimensions play a special role here, but four dimensions plays a special role. If you lived in a five-dimensional universe, this would go to zero as r went to infinity, but you don't. You live in a three-dimensional universe. Sometimes you do experiments in a two-dimensional universe, and for both those cases, this exponent is positive, and so the ratio of the nonlinear term to the linear terms goes to infinity as r perp goes to infinity. That means if you look at long distances, the nonlinear term becomes not less and less important, but more and more important. So the linear theory will not give a correct description of this system at large distances in any spatial dimension less than 4. Okay? That's good news if you want to get long-range order. It's bad news if you want to actually predict the properties of the system, in particular, what the real values of the exponents are. The values of the exponents that I found from the linear theory must be wrong because the linear theory is wrong. Okay? So what do you do? So it turns out that in two dimensions, you can do something pretty simple. Okay, so in two dimensions, things become simpler. And the reason for that is that if you look at that convective nonlinearity, and now let's think about two dimensions. Remember, u perp is the component of the velocity perpendicular to the mean velocity. But now imagine we're living in two dimensions and the mean velocity is that way. How many components are there perpendicular to that direction? Well, there's only one. So if that direction is x, there's only one component of u perpendicular to that, and that's the y component. Okay? So u perp dot grad perp u perp just becomes uy dy uy. And you don't have to remember much calculus to remember that that can be written as 1 half the y derivative of uy squared. So the nonlinearity in two dimensions becomes a total derivative. Furthermore, it's a total y derivative. So it can only affect things involving y derivatives. So here's my equation rewritten, taking that into account. And now I want to power count on this, keeping the nonlinear term. Well, we've already established that the nonlinear term has to be more important than some of the linear terms. If you look at this equation, since this involves a y derivative, and these terms also involve y derivatives, if it's going to be more important than any term in this equation, it has to be more important than these terms. So we throw these terms out, and we do our power counting keeping this term, the time derivative term, the nonlinear term, the x derivative term, and the force. Okay? And so you can do that power counting. Basically the same power counting that we did before. But now, instead of balancing all the linear terms, you balance this linear term, that linear term, and that linear term with this nonlinear term. You again get three equations for the three unknown exponents, chi, z, and where is it, zeta. And again, three equations and three unknowns, you can solve it. You can figure out the exponents just by counting on your fingers. So this is what you get when you solve these three linear equations. You get z is, if you solved it in general spatial dimension d, you would get twice d plus 1 over 5. This argument only works in two dimensions because it's only in two dimensions you can write this as a total y derivative. So if you plug in d equals 2 here, you get z is 6 fifths, zeta is 3 fifths, and chi is minus 1 fifth. So z being 6 fifths means that the time scales here scale like length scale to a power less than 2. So the motion is super diffusive. Information spreads more rapidly than diffusively in this system. The system is strongly anisotropic. The scaling of length scales in the parallel direction goes like the 3/5 power of length scales in the perpendicular direction. The really crucial thing is that this chi is now not zero, but it's actually negative. So that says the fluctuations get smaller and smaller as you look at bigger and bigger systems. So that says you can have long-range order. Okay. So that's all very nice. So that's the result in two dimensions. Okay, and an interesting comment. As the size of the flock goes to infinity, the lifetime of the order, the timescale over which the velocity will persist in a given direction, goes to infinity like the size of the flock, which means inevitably it's going to get to be much longer than the lifetime of an individual bird, which is quite striking. So I can start a big flock over here, start it moving in that direction. 1,000 generations later, when there are no survivors of the original flock, it's still moving in the same direction. It's almost like the Rolling Stones. Okay, so, Okay, so there's a bunch of stuff here that I'm not going to have time to get to, so I'll skip through this. Okay, but now you can ask, what happens in three dimensions? Well, in three dimensions, life gets a little harder because there's no way to write uperp.gradperp uperp as a total derivative. So I cannot do the simple power counting argument that I did in two dimensions. So instead, what you have to do is what we call a full-blown dynamical renormalization group. Okay? You also, remember when I did the calculation of the importance of the nonlinearity, I came to the conclusion that the critical dimension was 4. And it turns out you can use that fact to formally do this renormalization group in an expansion in powers of epsilon, where you define epsilon to be 4 minus the dimension of space, basically a measure of how far below the critical dimension you are. So what you do is you do a calculation as if epsilon was 0.01 or 0.02. You get an expansion in powers of that epsilon, and then you cover your eyes, you set epsilon equal to 1, and you take that number and you tell the experimentalist that's what we think the exponent is going to be. It sounds very contrived and sounds like it can't possibly work, but it has now an almost 50-year-old tradition of working very, very well in fields like critical phenomena, and we think it works here. So that's what we did. Now, we thought this was going to be a fairly simple calculation. You know, that equation of motion I had was already fairly simple, and it turns out there's only two important parameters in that equation, which you can make out of combinations of other parameters in these equations. There's a dimensionless nonlinear coupling, which goes like the noise strength, which I call D, that's the amplitude of the random forcing, goes like that coefficient lambda of the nonlinearity squared divided by some powers of the viscosities, and that's it. That ratio determines how important the nonlinear term is. And the other important parameter is just the ratio of the bulk viscosity to the shear viscosity. That's it. So we knew we'd be able to derive the normalization group recursion relations for these two quantities. If you haven't seen the normalization group before, all it is a way of relating the behavior of a system on one length scale to its behavior on larger length scales. And we thought this would be a straightforward calculation. We thought we would just get something like this. We'd get the, upon renormalization, this nonlinear coupling G1 would have some recursion relation that involved G1 and G2, and likewise G2. We were right as far as that went. What we didn't anticipate was the form of these functions G1 and G2, which are this. There's only two things I want you to take away from these two expressions. One is that they're very, very complicated. Right? The second one is that they each contain terms that blow up when G2, this ratio of bulk viscosity to shear viscosity, goes to 0. Right? This one has terms that go like 1 over G2 squared. This one has terms that go like 1 over G2 cubed. Nonetheless, just to give you an idea of how complicated this problem is, all of those divergent terms, and there are many of them, cancel exactly. And in fact, both of these functions are perfectly finite when G2 goes to 0. Very bizarre, but that's the way it works out. This took us a month, okay? So, but we got it, we finally all agreed on all these terms, we plotted these flows, we found a fixed point, there's only a single fixed point. The fixed point, amazingly enough, occurs at G2 equals 0, where those horrible expressions reduced to two very simple numbers, and we were able to get exponents. Okay. So these are the exponents we got. Remember, I told you we were gonna do this in an epsilon expansion, so you'll notice the first column here are the values of the exponents in four dimensions in the linear theory, and these order epsilon corrections are the corrections you get by doing this renormalization group approach. Then if you take these expressions and you cover your eyes and you set epsilon equal to 1, these are the numbers that you get. And believe it or not, for various reasons that I don't have time to go into, we actually believe these numbers to the second, to the number of decimal places that are shown. Sorry?
I didn't hear.
Oh, I'm sorry. So we take this epsilon expansion, we set epsilon equal to 1, that gives us these numbers, and we actually believe that these numbers are correct to the two decimal places shown.
So what are the fractions here? Are they approximate or something?
No, they're just, these coefficients are all simple fractions. And it's not at all obvious, if you looked at the horrible formula two transparencies back, it's not at all obvious that the coefficients you would get here would be simple fractions, but they turn out to be, to one loop order. And so if you set epsilon equal to 1, you get simple fractions here. And those are the fractions you get. Those are what you get if you work out what those fractions are. And we actually believe these to that number of decimal places.
So that's because of simulation?
No, it's, ask me that again in the question section, okay? Just because it takes a bit of time, but I'll tell you why we believe this. And we don't have any simulation results yet, but we think that when we get simulation results, they're gonna be within plus or minus 0.01 of these exponents. And I'll tell you why afterwards. Okay, so that's the result. So you'll notice chi is still negative, but that's not surprising. You got long-range order in three dimensions, even in the linear theory. But here you get a different value of chi. You still get a different value of z. The system does not behave diffusively. It still behaves anisotropically, and we think we can predict the behavior. Okay, so that's the story. So to summarize this, I would say, to me, the most general and interesting thing about this is that flocks illustrate how you can apply fundamental hydrodynamic principles like symmetries and conservation laws to understand anything. And the other point I want you to take away is that birth and death, by turning off number conservation, change the behavior of the flock in rather dramatic ways. Okay, and thanks for your attention, and I'm gonna let Thomas Malthus have the last word and take any questions you have. Thank you.